We've got a lot of things I want to talk with you about. I say that a lot, don't I? It seems. And then sometimes I get sidetracked. But as we talk about the responsibility of individuals in benevolence, I want to pursue this thought just a little bit more as we discussed Luke chapter 10 and what we read about the Good Samaritan. That rings bells, I'm sure, to the minds of all of you. As the Samaritan, traveling on a certain way from Jerusalem to Jericho, came upon a man who had been beaten and robbed and left for dead. And we find that once he saw him and saw him in distress, he bound up his wounds and carried him to an inn and gave money to the innkeeper and charged the innkeeper to keep this man. And he said, whatsoever you spend more, I'll give that to you when I come. We see this as an illustration of an individual who is providing help to anyone that he has opportunity to help. He saw this man in distress, he had the ability, and thus he responded. Now, that responsibility exists anywhere, with anybody. And as we identify responsibility, an old man a long time ago very simply told me that responsibility is response in accordance with ability. And that's a pretty good definition. Response in accordance with ability. Here we see that this Samaritan responded. He responded in accordance with the ability that he had. Thus, he had responsibility, and he assumed that individually to care for this man. And we have studied rather extensively from 1 Timothy chapter 5. And we've noted in that context that it discusses our individual responsibilities toward those of our family. Sometimes it might be parents. Sometimes it might be grandparents. Sometimes it might be children. It might sometimes be a widow, as we see discussed in verse 16. And in verse 16, the point is very simply made that here is your responsibility. You do this so that the church be not charged. Now, when you look at that expression, that here's something for you to do. If any has widows, let them care for them, that the church be not charged. When we read that statement, we see a distinction between the responsibility that the individual has, that the church be not charged. It draws a line between the individual and the entity that is called the church. So every time, or if every time, an individual does something, then that puts the church into work, then I wonder how in the world we would ever practice 1 Timothy 5, verse 16. How could any individual do something without it being the charge of the church if whatever the individual does activates the church? There would be no distinction. You couldn't practice that verse if your life depended on it. The very existence of that verse suggests that there is a distinction between the individual and the church. Now, in our study tonight, I want to begin with James chapter 1. Now, I know you've studied this extensively, and we talked about it just a little bit in our study last Wednesday night. And I want to talk about it just a little bit more, and then we're going to move on to Matthew, the 25th chapter. We've tried and tried in numerous studies, both on Sunday morning, Wednesday night, private studies, to emphasize the importance of context. Context often answers a lot of questions and helps us to keep from using passages incorrectly. As Paul writes to Timothy in 2 Timothy 2, verse 15, and tells him to give diligence to present thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing or handling aright the word of truth. You don't handle aright the word of truth when you study it without regard for context. Context is important. If you read this context, beginning at verse 19 down through verse 27, and examine the pronouns and the nouns in this text, you can't help but come to the conclusion that the writer is talking about what an individual practices. Look at the context, verse 19. Ye know this, my beloved brethren, but let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. For the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God. Wherefore, putting away all filthiness and overflowing of wickedness, receive with meekness the implanted word which is able to save your souls. But be ye doers of the word, and not hearers only, deluding your own selves.
For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, notice that. If anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like unto a man beholding his natural face in a mirror. For he beholdeth himself and goeth away, and straightway forgetteth what manner of man he was. But he that looketh into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and so continueth, being not a hearer that forgetteth, but a doer that worketh, this man shall be blessed in his doing. If any man thinketh himself to be religious, while he bridleth not his tongue, but deceiveth his heart, this man's religion is vain. Pure religion and undefiled before our God and Father is this: to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. Now, I want to ask, and just for my information's sake, how many of you in this audience have heard arguments made on this passage to teach that the church may support some kind of a benevolent institution, and in doing so, the church then is performing its work through this institution? How many of you have heard this passage used? All right. I want to pick on somebody that hasn't heard it. David Skinner, you didn't show your hand. Oh, you've heard that. Who hasn't heard it?
I was going to say, I think what I came out of, it was just so long assumed. Nobody based it on anything. It's just pure assumption.
You came out of a denominational religion. Yeah, yeah. Well, these are arguments that have been made by so-called gospel preachers that assume that they were sound in their teaching. And this was back in the 60s, late 50s, when churches were dividing over the practice of institutionalism. Now, anyone not hear that argument? Joe, you've not heard that argument? All right, good. Well, I want to pick on you, okay? Sometimes to get a perspective on a passage, it's good to pick on somebody that doesn't have any reason to be biased at all. And as you haven't heard that argument made, does this passage, when you read through it, and that's all we've done, just to read through the passage, does it describe to you something that the church is to practice, or is it describing something the individual is to practice?
I think using verse 26 with this, no, it's individual.
That convinces you? All right, that's right, you're good. Let's pat you on the back, you did well. Well, again, the point, yes, verse 26, if any man thinketh himself to be religious. He's identifying a man's religion. And then defining that, he says, pure and undefiled religion before God is this: to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. So pure and undefiled religion is not just a profession. It's something that you practice, which the context is discussing all the way down from verse 19. This is what you practice. He's not discussing collective or church action at all. He's discussing what you do. Now, often the argument, Joe, is made, well then, if an individual practices pure and undefiled religion by visiting the fatherless and the widows in their affliction, then how does a local congregation practice pure and undefiled religion? May then the church visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction? Now somebody respond to that. Randy?
The church is a collective noun. It's made up of people who visit the fatherless and the widows.
All right. That's correct. The church is a collective noun. And individuals do this, but that does not constitute the church doing it. Terry?
Well, now, you can go through the first chapter there, as we did, and you can underline all of the pronouns in the first chapter. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
And so then, that argument, that observation is very difficult to refute. So what has to happen then is you have to try and become
Yes, and that won't wash.
And that's how some try to get from point A to point B.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the argument.
Now, Carolyn has made an interesting observation from her background in the Presbyterian Church, that this was just something that was done and no particular passage was ever needed or cited to authorize the practice. Now, I want you in this class to watch carefully. We're in an area in the high desert that is in some respects somewhat isolated. It's a long way to go to another Church of Christ. I suppose that Sarah would probably say that Ridgecrest is probably the closest, and it very well may be. You've got to travel some distance. But the point is, we're in somewhat of an isolated area. In areas where I have lived in the past, in areas where I hold a number of meetings, this kind of division is very prominent. And there is a drifting among what I will call institutional or very liberal-minded brethren toward the position that Carolyn came from in denominationalism. Now, that's significant. There are those, what I'm trying to say, among preachers in churches of Christ that are moving in that direction to make arguments that really have no foundation, no passage offered. Just assume that this is something that's good because now we've got a generation on the scene that has been brought up in this environment of liberal thinking. And where that always leads is to the position that we really don't need Bible to practice what we do. David, you had a question or a comment?
No.
Okay. In our next point, we've talked about and you've discussed, and in this class I have and Terry has when I was away, discussed James chapter 1, verse 27. I don't want to belabor the point. I want us to turn now to Matthew, the 25th chapter. This is where we left off in our last study. And I want to reiterate some things because I'm convinced that this passage becomes rather an easy passage to show the consequences of the argument that whatever an individual does, the church is doing. Matthew, the 25th chapter. You'll notice, first of all, in Matthew 25, beginning at verse 31, it says, "But when the Son of Man shall come in His glory, and all the angels with Him, then shall He sit on the throne of His glory. And before Him shall be gathered all the nations, and He shall separate them one from another, as the shepherd separateth the sheep from the goats." Notice that this separation is not a separation of local churches, is it? You'll notice at verse 32, "Before Him shall be gathered all the nations, and He shall separate them from another, as the shepherd separateth the sheep from the goats." This is not a separation of nations. It's not a separation of local congregations. Judgment that's described in this context is an individual judgment based on what you do individually. Now let's notice again the context in verse 33. "And He shall set the sheep on His right hand, but the goats on the left. Then shall the King say unto them on His right hand," now look at your Bibles, "Come, ye blessed of My Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and ye gave Me to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave Me to drink. I was a stranger, and ye took Me in. Naked, and ye clothed Me. I was sick, and ye visited Me. I was in prison, and ye came unto Me." Now, if the argument that whatever the individual does, the church does, has any merit at all, if there is a parallel in the argument that James 1:27 authorizes the church to support institutions to do this work, then you would have to follow that parallel through the text of Matthew 25. Now here's where you wind up when you do that. When Jesus said, "I was hungry and you gave Me to eat," did you just authorize Church of Christ restaurants to be supported by Churches of Christ to provide food for the needy? Is that what you just did? If you take that position and be consistent, you can't help but go there. And when He says, "I was thirsty and you gave Me to drink," we just put in a Church of Christ soda fountain supported by Churches of Christ to provide drink to those who are thirsty, didn't we? And He says, "I was a stranger, and you took Me in."
Now we've just authorized the institution of a hotel, Church of Christ Hotel, supported by Churches of Christ, to put up those who need a room. Well, read on. I was naked and ye clothed me. Now we've got a Church of Christ department store supported by Churches of Christ to give clothing to those who need it. Well, read on. I was sick and ye visited me. Now we've just authorized Church of Christ hospitals so that folks who need medical care can go there and be supported by Churches of Christ. Now you look at these arguments and you smile and say, well, preacher, that's getting kind of silly. Folks are doing it, brethren. There are Church of Christ hospitals supported by Churches of Christ so that you can go there and have medical care. And either the costs are far less or you can have it for free. Now, that's being done. Now, that kind of gets your attention, don't it? People are doing that. And as you read on, I was in prison and ye came unto me. Now, you don't want to go there with that one, do you? Church of Christ prisons. I don't know how you'd work that out where Churches of Christ support the prison for you to go there and be incarcerated. But that would demand consistency, wouldn't it? That would have to follow. If whatever the individual does, then that activates the church. The church is doing it. Now, if that's not so, and if you see any kind of a flaw or loophole in that kind of reasoning to remain consistent, you show me where it is. I'll be glad to talk with anybody. David, you see a hole in that?
No.
Oh.
What I was going to say is I've heard of and the liberal brethren in Columbia, because they even have joint efforts a lot of times with other denominations.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. And these become joint efforts. Whatever they're doing, we're doing. And I have read some material in the last few years where lectureship programs, like we're planning for November, lectureship programs, there's not really any distinction being made between fellow that teaches the truth and somebody that is over here preaching in a denominational religion. Randy? Yes. 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 That's correct. Yeah, got the whole ball of wax. Yeah, and I got a story to tell you about that.
But the other end of that thought was just that it completely takes the responsibility off of the individual.
Oh, yeah.
It says you don't have to do anything.
That's right.
The church is taking care of all of it.
That's right. Response to these arguments that I made in, I guess it was the late 70s, early 80s, was that if an individual, or if I as an individual, go to a child that doesn't have a place to live and I buy him a Coca-Cola and a Snickers bar, and you take the amount that cost, and here's a large congregation that sends $200 to this children's home, if you take the money that I spent to buy this child a Coca-Cola and a Snickers bar and divide what you sent by the number of members in the congregation, I've done more than any one of you did. Now, why divide the church over that? You've relieved yourself of the responsibility and assigned it to the institution.
That turns the church into a money-making.
That's right. That's all it becomes.
Fundraiser.
Just a fundraiser. Richard?
I was going to say that a lot of people say when you make arguments like you've just made over the last several minutes, that, well, you're just going overboard with that. But the fact of the matter is, as Randy pointed out, there is no natural stopping point there.
That's
once
right.
You have violated the authority of the Scripture. There is absolutely no place to stop.
That's right.
So the congregation having a room in the back where they keep a couple of pieces of clothing to hand out to people that might come by, there's no difference between that and a Church of Christ department store. There is no difference. If you can go that far,
to remain consistent. That's right. You can just go right on down the hill. Now, you mentioned the Catholic Church. For you young folks, I want you to listen to this. In 1984, 5, long and through there, There was a young preacher in Arkansas that preached right across town, and it was almost a stone's throw because town wasn't that big. But point being that I went to visit this young man, and I wanted to talk with him about some of the differences that existed between us. We had a dialogue, somewhat so, and a lot of the folks that went there I knew. I visited with them in their homes. Many of them we were able to teach the truth, some we were not. Enough so that they wanted to have someone come and what they called refute the errors of antiism. We'll talk about that at another time. But they selected and advertised a man that they thought that was the best in the brotherhood and sent out this letter to all of their members. Well, naturally, I got one because I knew some of these people. They sent it on to me. But I went over to visit with this fella and talk with him about some of the differences that we had. I walked into his office, and you know what he said? Let me ask you, Jonathan, if you walked into a preacher's office to study something with you, and he said, I've got the debate books up here on the shelves. He said, those older and wiser men couldn't resolve these things. No point in you and I even talking about it. Would you be impressed or disappointed? I was very disappointed. He wouldn't even talk to me. Wouldn't even talk to me. But in the dialogue that we had, whether he wanted to talk with me or not, interestingly enough, we were studying with the same family. He would go and I would go. And I tried to get them to invite him to come when I was there and we could have a real good discussion. Well, he wouldn't do it. So what he wound up doing is preaching some sermons on these things. Well, much like what we do with the charts, he made copies of his sermons so that they could be passed out for further study. Well, naturally, I got a copy of them. And with this family with whom we were studying, I took his notes, went right down through his notes, sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph, got right down through his notes, and here's what he said that's right. This is good. He's not wrong on this. But here's what he says on this, and it's not right. And here's why it's not right. Now, Randy, the very point that you were making about the Catholic Church, here's what I asked them to ask him regarding this sponsoring church arrangement that they were involved with. If it would be all right for a local church to send me to the Catholic Church to teach them and expose the errors of Catholicism. Would that be scriptural? Now, how would you answer that, James?
All in how many synagogues and taught the truth?
Well, you mean my success rate would be a determining factor in the scripturalness of it?
No.
All right, would it be scriptural for me to teach at a Catholic church and expose the errors of their doctrine? Would that be scriptural for the church here to send me to the Catholic Church with the effort to try to convince them what they're doing is wrong? Yes, it would. That'd be fine. Next question. Would it then be scriptural for the church here to print up material and try to get it into the hands of those who are members of the Catholic Church to expose the errors of Catholicism? Would that be scriptural? Yes, it would. Now, here's the third question. Would it be scriptural for us to send money to the Catholic Church and let them get the preacher and let them print the materials? Now, what's the difference? That's what you've got. You've lost the oversight. Now, that's Catholicism. Now, they presented this argument to this preacher when he came the next time. You know how he responded to that? You'll find this interesting. He said, "Why, we're not the Catholic Church, and we're not sending to the Catholic Church. We're sending to our brethren." Now, you know what the next question is? Reckon how the Catholic Church got started. Now, that's the next question. Guess what? He didn't come visit with them anymore. They identified with us. Pardon me?
Error is error,
and you can't be consistent when you first start down that path. That's right. That's right. Now, what Randy has pointed out is important because this evolution of thought process to become more and more and more and more and more lenient resulted in the development of the Catholic Church. That's exactly how it began. It began with a deterioration within elderships of local churches. That's what it does, yes. And the thing that's so strange about that is it's called Roman Catholic Church, which the word Roman means local. You got a local. And the word Catholic means universal. So what you're saying is local universal church. That won't work at all. Seems like a contradiction of terms, doesn't it? Well, it is. Now, your point is valid. If we don't see the distinction between the individual and the church, the ultimate end is where you've arrived with the development of Roman Catholicism. Now I want to review with you just briefly on some of these things. We see there is a responsibility of the church in benevolence. We've read it in Acts 2, Acts 4, and Acts 6. David? When you can't teach them, yeah, you've got to try to teach them. And when that appears to be unsuccessful. Someone told me a while back, David, that you teach the truth. You teach it the very best that you can. You keep hammering and hammering and hammering the truth. And the issue of fellowship generally takes care of itself. Now, I believe that's so. Either if you're teaching the truth and there's some that don't want it, they'll go somewhere else. Or if you're one in the pew and you're hammering the truth, you'll be packing going somewhere else. Now that's just how that works. Yes, Randy?
But in the spirit of the New Testament, it's necessary to try and make yes. it better first.
Yes, you've got to try.
No. You can't just show up and say, well, everything, there's no good church there, I'm out of here.
Yeah. Well, we're following a tangent here, but I've got to say this relative to that. I think there are many churches that lose ground. Simply because those who know the truth don't stay and fight the battles. And sometimes there are elders that become a detriment to a local congregation because when something is introduced that's tough or hard to deal with, they resign and often dissolves the eldership and leaves them right in the middle of a problem to try to resolve the problem when they're not used to dealing with anything because there are elders that have overseen them. And so now there's the transition from having elders to not having elders, and it's right in the middle of a big mess. And I believe there's some folks going to be held responsible for those kind of things. There are battles to be fought. And sometimes we just have to step to the plate, even though we don't feel we're as competent or prepared as someone else might be. It's time to step to the plate and fight the battle. You learn how to fight when you're in the fight. Okay? Any other comments or questions? All right. The responsibility of the church. We've studied it from, and I know that doesn't show up so well. Let me read it to you. The local church is obligated to relieve the wants of its own number who are in need. We see that in Acts 2 in the establishment of the church in Jerusalem. How that there they had houses and lands, Acts 2 and Acts 4. And they sold them and laid the money at the feet of the apostles so that distribution could be made to those who were in need. We know that was in Jerusalem because that was the only church that existed at the time. And then in Acts chapter 6, we find that there were Grecian widows that it was considered were being neglected in the daily ministration. And so there were those who were chosen from among them, that is, the church in Jerusalem, selected certain men to take care of this business. Now what we're seeing is that here are men who are selected from the brethren in Jerusalem to take care of a need that existed right there. Now as we look in our Bibles at Acts the 11th chapter, this is on your list to memorize so you know what's in this passage, right? In Acts the 11th chapter, there was a man named what? He came down from where? And he prophesied concerning a famine that was come to pass, and it came to pass when? You got all that, James?
The man's name was Agabus.
Yes, sir. And he came down from
Jerusalem.
To?
Antioch.
And he prophesied in the days of
Claudius.
You did good on that. You did very good. Now, when Agabus prophesied about that, Jonathan, how did the church at Antioch respond?
They sent out Paul and Barnabas.
All right.
Sent funds to the church in Judea.
All right, that's right. And there's a word that's used in that text that becomes very important. What did they send?
Relief.
That's right. They sent relief. Now, John, can you tell me why that word is so important? They sent relief. What does that indicate the condition of the churches was?
They were in need. They weren't sending luxuries. They were sending necessary items.
All right. Now, when you think of a famine, you're not thinking about sending somebody a brand new Hummer, are you? You're talking about sending them food to eat, water to drink, the necessities of life, or the equivalent in funds to buy those things that they need to survive.
The marginal reference says literally the word means service.
All right.
It says service.
All right. What service did they send during the days of a famine?
Food.
All right. Does the word relief mean the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, in the Greek, is that the same word?
Now, that I can't tell you. The word in 1 Corinthians 16 is collection for the needy saints. You might check that for me, Richard, on your computer or in your...
My computer were working, I would.
Oh, well, mine's working. Can't do it. 1 Corinthians 16, probably 2, the word need. And then compare that to the word relief in Acts 11. I believe it's about verse 32 is where that finds, or where that's found. Now he's looking, I'm sure, in a Greek Bible, I think is what you have in your hand there. Yeah, okay. If you can find those words, it might be, of course, easier if you had an interlinear, but be that as it may. See what you can find on that, and we're going to move on with our study. And when you get it, why, let me know. But what we do see, here is the church in Antioch, and they're sending relief. And they're sending it, by the way, to brethren. We want to make that note. It's not something they send out generally to all of those in Judea, but they sent it to the brethren that dwelt in Judea. Now note that the famine was throughout all the world. Why didn't the church at Antioch send it there? But they sent it to the brethren that dwelt in Judea, which becomes evidence further of the nature of the work of the church. Now, we've talked about 1 Corinthians 16, 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9, and Romans chapter 15. Now you remember these, right? I want you to catalog them in your mind. A local church doing its own work of benevolence among its own members. Where do we read about that, Bruce? Its own members. Not there. That's on its own members. That goes outside.
Acts 2:4-6.
Acts 2:4-6. Church at Jerusalem. You knew that, didn't you? I knew you knew that. That's what I did. I know it. Got him all mixed up. Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, Acts 2:4-6. A local church doing its own work among themselves. A local church sending to a plurality of churches. Joe, where'd I read that? That's Acts 11. Yes. Now, these passages, 1 Corinthians 16, 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, Romans 15, deal with a multiplicity of churches sending to one church. Now, I want you to remember them in that way, catalog them in that way. When you do that, you stand prepared to show somebody how the Bible talks or teaches that the church does its work in the realm of benevolence. Okay? Now, that's what I want you to remember. But even in these passages, there's something that we want to remember.
This was a temporary arrangement. These sending churches were never obliged to send to this church in Jerusalem on a constant, continual basis. It was a temporary arrangement until the need was supplied. And what we notice in 1 Timothy 5, also at verse 16, regarding the responsibility of widows to the church, or the church to widows. A church may support a widow who is in need temporarily, like anyone else who is in need, but cannot enroll or take her into the number. Now, we talked about that. That means permanent from now on, the rest of her life. Can't do that, you see. Now, as we're clear on that, right? The church can supply a temporary need for anybody that is a member of the body of Christ. I didn't say that like I want to say it. I want to say that a little more precisely. A local church may supply the needs of any member who becomes destitute temporarily. A local church may supply the needs of a widow indeed permanently. Now, that's where I want to stop with that. And what was the cause? There's one circumstance. Terry, you've hammered this point home many times. The circumstance where one church sent to another church was always that there may be equality. There was a need that existed in the receiving church. There was never, ever, not one time, a promoted need. That is, a church took on some big project and then it didn't have the money to do it. That's a promoted need. Terry?
Yeah, promoted need versus a need that the receiving congregation could not fill.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Point number three, the need was always temporary, and benevolence was sent only until the need was satisfied. Now, when the need was satisfied, there wasn't just an ongoing greasing of the machinery. But with the issue of institutionalism, where a church sends funds to an institution to do some work, that thing never ends. If one work is accomplished, then another work is chosen. So now we see that the thing just continues to be propagated. All right? Yes, Carolyn?
On your letter B, that term, I don't remember us having that specific term before. Is that, would that be referring to something like building an abortion home, whatever?
Yeah. You know, we get letters about that. I want to talk about that. That's a good question. Terry's got a comment or maybe a question. We want to respond to that. Okay, go a little further with that.
I'm just pointing out that that actually, in fact, does occur. That is an example of what Carolyn...
Well, yes, we get letters frequently where some are wanting to construct a building and they want us to send them money to construct the building. Now, let me present a scenario, okay? Suppose that you and Randy and Penny and Terry and Bruce, that constitutes the local church in this area. No more here than that who are Christians. Can we meet in your house? All right, now if we begin to convert some other people, and we've got about 12 of us now, can we meet in your house? All right, let's suppose we continue to convert folks and we grow to now there's about 20 of us. Can we meet in your house? All right. Do you think among 20 of us that we might have enough resources to obtain a room that's big enough for 20 people? Now, let's just suppose that we grow a little more. Now there's 50 of us. You think among 50 people there would be enough resources for us to obtain a place to meet that would accommodate 50 people? Now, here's what happens. Here's a local church that grows, and now there are maybe about 30, 40 people, maybe 50 people, and they want to construct a building. They want to have a new building. And so they send out letters all over the country, send us money so we can build a new building. Now, what's your thoughts on that?
They need to, like an individual needs to live within their means, they need to exist within their...
All right. Does that constitute benevolence? Does that constitute benevolence?
No, it's not relief in order to survive.
All right. In the realm of evangelism, what becomes the pattern in the New Testament? Churches send to the preacher. You see. Now, I guess what I'm searching for is something in the Bible that authorizes a local church to send to another local church to construct a building. All right. Randy, comment.
That's what I was going to say. But I was just going to put it differently.
All right. Yeah. That's where we're at. Yeah, that's where we're at. You see, but the time a church becomes large enough to need a building, then they have the resources to supply a building. Now, whether we build one, whether we rent a room somewhere, we can supply a meeting place. Might be in somebody's backyard, but we can supply a meeting place. Terry? That's right.
To another congregation.
Yeah, that's right.
That is a pattern.
I want to underscore the importance of these things. I know that some of you who are younger, you've not traveled this path, and maybe some of this say, well, that's kind of boring study. These are the very kind of things that have divided local churches. Just divided them. Now, maybe I'm just sensitive about that, but if the Lord purchased the church with His blood, I kind of hate to see it divided. And if we don't lay the groundwork on these kind of things, then eventually we're going to have to make a decision on something very similar to this, but it will be based on the same foundation principles that we're talking about. And so we've got to learn these things. You know, when I was in school, I didn't like history. I thought it was terrible. I didn't like having to learn the facts and trying to get them in order and trying to remember the dates and all of that. I didn't like history. To me, it seemed boring. Didn't like to study it. Now I see some purpose for having studied it, and I kind of like history. And so these things, we may look upon and say, well, you know, that's just a whole lot of facts and history of this happened to that happened. It gets real technical. But when you see the application of it, when churches divide over these kind of things, we've got to know what the book says. Carolyn?
In thinking about this and scenarios, suppose that you have some sort of disaster, like one after Katrina or all kinds of, you know, such situations. Would you have, say, a church being able to send relief, food, so forth, to the church for members, but then would individuals be able to send a check to help them rebuild their building?
Absolutely.
But the church would not be authorized.
Correct. That's absolutely right. That's right. And the text that I would look at in the instance would be Acts chapter 5. In Acts chapter 5, concerning Ananias and Sapphira, who lied and died in 5, you know, you got to put the southern accent or it won't rhyme. But when you do that, you can remember where it is. But they lied and died in 5. Now, what we learn about that was, Peter told them, while it was yours, before it was sold, wasn't it yours? After it was sold, wasn't the money in your hand? You see, the problem was they lied about it. But while it was theirs, what could they do with it? Whatever they wanted to. That's right. Terry and then Richard. All right. Richard and then Roy. He beat you to it.
I have the definitive answer.
Oh, got that. All right. Same word or not, James? Yes or no?
The definitive long answer is no.
Okay, not same word.
So in Acts 11:29, it's diakonia, and in 1 Corinthians 16:2, it's logia.
Okay.
One means collection, gathering, and the other one has to do with ministering to.
Okay, completely different. All right. I want to move quickly, as I know Richard is going to push that buzzer. An emergency always existed before other churches were asked to assist, like you talked about, for a famine. It was an emergency. No church both received and sent funds. That is, the sponsoring church arrangement of today did not exist, whereby one church assumed the centralized oversight of a work and at the same time received funds from several churches for that work, and then sent funds to other churches that had assumed work of another particular project. You see the picture? I've got to come up with a chart. I've looked at it, and I have one for an overhead, and it's so worn you can't... I need to rebuild it on the computer, Richard. That would be a good task. But anyhow, what it shows is one church that has a particular project that it's doing. And here is another church over here that's sending to this church so it can participate in that church's peculiar project. But now here's another church up here, and it's got a peculiar project, so this church is now sending to that one. And guess what? This one's sending to that one, and that one's sending back to this one. So you've got money just crossing paths and winds up at the same place it was sent, but for different projects, you see. Now that's what you've got when you have this kind of arrangement. You don't read anything like that in the Bible. Furthermore, each church selected its own messenger and did not depend upon one sponsoring church to serve as the messenger or overseer of their own responsibility. Now, you can read about messengers in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, and you'll notice there that Paul admonished those churches to select their own messengers who could travel with him. Now, he said, here's the reason. So that I might maintain things honorable in the sight of all men. Now, if this local church was to send funds to another local church as benevolence because they had some members that had needs beyond which they could supply, we might choose a messenger, that is, someone that we might have confidence in, to deliver the funds promptly and appropriately. Now, we're going to make an analogy here that you're going to remember a bit further down the line as we talk in our next study about the autonomy of a local church. The messenger that we might select might be the U.S. Postal System. We can select that messenger because they will deliver it and they won't open the letter. They will deliver it promptly and appropriately. Now, if we can select that as a messenger, does then the United States Postal System have the right to take the money out of the envelope and make some kind of a decision about how it's going to be spent?
We won't know until next week.
I bet we will. I see enough heads shaking to know that answer. No, they don't have that kind of legislative authority. All they are is a messenger. Now, those who were traveling with Paul did not constitute any kind of legislative body. Now, the reason I say that is there was a preacher in northeast Arkansas that was trying to justify this institutional arrangement where an institution is governed by a board of directors on the basis of that argument. He said Paul and those messengers traveling with him constituted a board of directors, and Paul was chairman of the board. I nearly fell over in my chair. Such ludicrous arguments. Now, you see how folks reason to try to get from point A to point B, Terry. We're going to do this. I don't care what kind of argument we have to establish to do it. We're going to do it. Now that's where it is. Thank you.
Oh, by the way, if you don't have a copy of lesson number 11 on the autonomy of the local church, that's where we're going when this number 10